Well, I think we will begin. I'm Cynthia Molavita, and this is the third in five sessions in which called The Foolishness of God and Love at the Political Ecological Location. And we, first let me ask, how many people, are there? Is there anyone here who has not been here at previous sessions? Okay. Then we'll do a very brief bit of reviewing because there's just a lot of ground to cover today. We have been digging into what can be understood as the basic calling or vocation for Christian life, and that is to love the Lord thy God. Jesus said, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love neighbor as self. So we're taking that love thy neighbor as thyself and really trying to dig into what on earth does that mean in our day and age. That question has been a central question for the church and for the people Israel before the church, our forebears, for millennia. What does it mean to love neighbor as self in our context? Yesterday, we came up with a number of characteristics of love as a biblical norm, and I'm going to recount three of those. One being that love is a steadfast, faithful commitment to serve the well-being of the other. To serve the well-being of the loved. A steadfast commitment to serve the well-being of. A second characteristic of love as a biblical virtue, and as we see it developing in the work of the church through the ages, is that my neighbor is whomever my life touches. So clearly my neighbor isn't just my neighbor, literally, or my coworker, or my family. My neighbor is whomever my life touches. And in the context of, in the context of the global economy, my life touches people in every part of the globe. The people that make my clothing, that produce my food, that get the impact of my fossil fuel, of my greenhouse gas production, my life touches people all over. So neighbor's love will serve the well-being of neighbor. Neighbor is whomever my life touches. And third, where the neighbor suffers under injustice, love, that is the commitment to the neighbor's well-being, will seek to dismantle that injustice and will seek justice. These are, in a sense, these are basic logic. But when we hold those together, then we get this huge question. What does it mean to love neighbor as self in the context of structural injustice? And we've looked at, in particular, structural injustice at this point that leads to two of the fundamental defining realities of our day. An unsustainable relationship between the human species and the planet. We're an endangered species, as well as the many other species that we've already destroyed. And secondly, a gap between the rich and the poor that is unthinkable. A gap between the rich and the poor that none of us, if we really took it seriously, could possibly live accepting. Given that for many, poverty means death. And also that's a quote that's in my heart from a Jesuit priest in El Salvador that said that in the context of a small group meeting. I would like us today to ask that question. Well, I want you to wait. And the work of today is that it's in the context of that question. Where neighbors are suffering as a result of systemic injustice, systemic sin in theological terms, God's call to love neighbor as self is a call to address that injustice. It is a call to seek justice for the service of ending the neighbor's suffering. So in the light of massive suffering caused by systemic injustice, I will suggest that the call to love neighbor as self presents some vexing problems. And you all have noted some of those problems as we've been discussing. Because there are a few people here who haven't been here and the previous two sessions, I'd like to take 3 or 4 minutes just to summarize, in a sense, what we've been talking about of what is meant by systemic injustice or systemic sin. And I think one way that I can do that is just to read about 3 or 4 paragraphs. And again, here, this is to go back to what do we mean by systemic sin, because we spent most of yesterday on that topic. This is a paragraph from a book that I did on economic globalization and moral spiritual power for resisting the exploitative parts of it and going in different directions. And this is from a chapter that is looking at, this is the end chapter that's kind of a story, and it's looking at the story of a congregation. And I'm imagining it could be my congregation. So in reading a couple of paragraphs here, I hope that you will get a sense of, those of you who weren't here before, what we're meaning by systemic sin. Okay, this congregation began with a day in the life of many in this congregation. They take their Christian faith seriously and seek to live in accord with it. I'm going to use first person because it could be my congregation, which I love and respect tremendously. We are aware of our call to follow Jesus and mature in many ways of doing it. We worship God faithfully, pray, tend compassionately to one another's pain and brokenness, give generously to the church and to charities, serve children of the city as coaches and friends, bring consolation to others facing death or loss, are compassionate to animals, volunteer in soup kitchens and schools, are adept in the life-giving art of friendship. In very important and real senses, we are marvelously formed by our faith to love neighbor as self. However, we do not notice that our ways of life are fatally harmful to many people and other living things. That story is a harsh one. To simply tell it and stop there would be to sow denial or despair. I will not. Bear with that story, however, for a moment, in oversimplified form, for the purpose of seeing and then composing a different story. The people of this congregation do not notice that with their cars, large houses, and frequent travel, they contribute, we contribute 500 times. Yesterday I said 150, but I checked my documentation, it's 500. 500 times more greenhouse gas per person than does the average Nepalese. We do not see that oil sustaining our lifestyle comes from the Niger Delta in Africa, where Chevron, Shell, and Mobil are cutting down forests, polluting water supplies and air, and, I quote, mowing down indigenous cultures and communities, end quote. The people of this congregation do not hear the voices of African people demanding oil companies to leave the Delta, or the Andean indigenous peoples threatening mass suicide if oil companies begin operations in their lands. Nor do they see the thousands of troops deployed to quell the protest in the Niger Delta. We seek prudently goodbyes in clothing. I got it, but I only got it for $5. It was on sale for $5. Goodbyes in clothing and feel good about it, without knowing of the young women in the Tianjin garment factory in China who sew that clothing for 23 cents an hour, 60 hours a week, are prevented from organizing and will be laid off when Walmart moves its contract to another factory in southern China with fewer regulations and far lower wages. The people in our story have enjoyed high investment returns, well, until recently, of course. Their investments fund a mining company that has displaced thousands of Dalits and other indigenous peoples of India from the land that had enabled them to feed their children and sustain their health systems, values, and familial structures and identity for generations. Many of those people have now moved into urban poverty in the cities in India. Church members' homes are lighted by General Electric bulbs. General Electric's CEO, former CEO, Jack Walsh, personally took home more pay in 1999 than all the company's 15,000 factory workers in Mexico combined. The workers have left their home areas to work in plants in the toxic free trade zone of northern Mexico because the corn production and communally owned lands that formerly sustained their lives were undercut by Monsanto, the seed company, under the rules of the North America Free Trade Agreement. Monsanto provides our congregation with low-priced food and investment returns. I could go on and on, but that's what the kinds of things we were talking about in looking at what we mean by being in bondage to or participating in structural sin, the characteristics of which are those not disadvantaged by it tend not to see it, and secondly, it goes on regardless of the goodness and virtue, the goodness and virtue and loving beings of the people implicated in it. So, in that context, this call to love neighbor as self is, to say the least, problematic. Now, you all, especially yesterday, identified a lot of those problems, or those conundrums, as we could say. I'd like to explore some of those, and in particular, summarize three sort of problems that I think speak to much of what you said yesterday. I'd also like to talk with us about some ways in which Lutheran theology can give guidance in dealing with those problems. Now, I firmly believe that we are deterred from exercising our moral agency, our power to move from the way things are with structural sin toward alternatives. We're deterred, we're disabled, we're truncated in that by many things. And one of those is problems that we don't face, name, articulate, and therefore overcome. I remember in some, I think it was some Union book that talked about the image of you're riding in a small boat in a rough lake and all of a sudden a sea monster comes at you. If you look at it, face it, you can, well, let's not go to that metaphor. Forget it. Let's go to another one. We're going to go too far now. James Baldwin said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless it is faced." And I think that naming the issues, be it in interpersonal relationships, with a spouse, with a kid, is the first step to overcoming them. So I think that one of our problems, and I heard this from all of you yesterday, and some of you yesterday, is that of moral ambiguity. So we are friends of God. We're empowered by God to receive God's love and embody it by living it into the world. We're given this life work of receiving God's love, trusting it, embodying it, and living it out again. God, we're here so God can work in us and through us. I think this is stated beautifully in the ELCA Constitution. How many of you are Lutheran? It's only nice. I didn't mean it's nice because it's better. It's only nice because I'm drawing upon Lutheran theology. But being an ecumenist, I could draw on many theologies. But here in the ELCA Constitution, in just one spot, the assembly of baptized believers sharing word and supper, that is the church, is created and claimed by God in Christ and empowered by the Holy Spirit in order to worship God and proclaim and participate in what God is doing in the world. End quote. So we're part of that cloud of witnesses throughout the ages, claimed, gathered, and sent by God's grace to give thanks for the work of God in the world, witness to it, and give it social form. Give it form in society. Live out that love in our worlds, in our world. To participate in what God is doing in the world. Okay, it sounds very, very, very sweet. But amidst the complexity, the moral ambiguity of life, how are we mere humans to discern what God is doing in the world, with whom and where, so that we can align ourselves with that, so that we can align ourselves with God's work to participate in it. Have mercy on us, Lord. So often, we simply do not know what you are doing in the world. How then can we participate in it? I'd like you to think for a moment. What do you see as clues to discerning what God is doing in the world? If I put that question to you, how do you discern what God is doing so that you can participate in it? What are some clues to that? What would you say? Yes.
If somehow you get word that there are a lot of people that are becoming believers in God, maybe some tribe somewhere, more enough so that it's kind of a newsworthy event or whatever, I would say that God is working there.
That could be an indication of God's activity in the world. Okay, very good. Very good. Other things? Yes?
Maybe putting impoverished people before us. That these are people that we need.
Okay. Okay, if we understand that God had this has this particular leaning and compassion for those who are impoverished, then and is serving them, then to participate in God's work would be to be there. Okay, another good point. Other thoughts? Yes.
And to work with people who are empowering disadvantaged people to with themselves.
Okay. Okay. Another good key or clue? Very good. Others? Yes. Say your name.
Jennifer.
Please. Jennifer, okay.
I've been trying to remind myself often to pay attention to things which I, at first glance, assume are coincidences. And then think about them and realize they're probably not coincidences.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Bob?
To draw our attention to some of these unpleasant truths.
To draw, and why would you see that as very good, a clue to God's work in the world?
Well, reminding us of what we're here for.
Okay, reminding us of what we're here for.
So we need to look at those things and then ask questions about them. The worst thing, we want to ignore them and suppress that information.
Okay. That reminds me very much of, I would see one grounds for that statement, Bob, as the way Jesus operated. Continually reminding people of these truths that they wanted to ignore.
Right.
And then forcing them to ask questions because doggone, he spoke in parables without clear answers.
I'm just kind of piggybacking on his comment. But you know, how about the classic old statement of, the gospel comforts those who are afflicted and afflicts those who are comfortable. Sometimes, when we see something, we're a little bit like, ugh. That twist of the knife kind of, ugh, that might be a clue that there's something wrong here.
Very good. I think these are all worthy ideas. Speak for a minute or think for a minute about dangers of the claim that I know what God is doing in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I worry that we, from our perspective, almost see those in need as God's work for us to redeem ourselves.
God doesn't
put them in need for us, for our salvation.
Okay. That was one of Martin Luther's main points in the Reformation, that what people were doing, he radically revised the approach to the poor. And one of the things was people were seeing the poor as people that they could serve and by serving win salvation. And Luther said, you ain't going to win salvation by serving the poor. We don't need the poor there for you to win salvation by your good deeds. Okay? Other problems. I have just asserted to you that our lives should be guided by participating in what we think God is doing in the world. I mean that, and yet I say it with tremendous caution also. Because I see people participating in God, what they claim to be God's work in the world, and in so doing, flying airplanes into the Twin Towers, waging war on Iraq as participation in God's holy work, What other things are done in the name of God? Burning or attacking abortion-giving doctors? Can you think of any other things?
With
certainty that this is God's will.
What about hastening
the end time?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, very good. Hastening the end time, that the war in Iraq is very important because it is hasted, according to the Bible, that war in that region will precede the second coming of Christ. Okay.
Well, and even in the global global warming and so forth, Barbara Rossi has talked about that in her books about how some certain Christian groups hastening the end of the world via ecological destruction because all the better to get there quicker.
Okay,
right?
That's right. Okay. Now, the scary thing is that these claims, many of these claims of doing stuff in the name of God, are in fact made in good faith. They're made by people who really believe it. And I know we can make fun of some of that, et cetera, but on the other hand, they're made, not all of them. I mean, some people are out there to wreak havoc and gain glory and whatever. But some people are in good faith, saying, I must do. Think of the people that sometimes in good faith say horrible things about gay and lesbian people. And they're holding signs and they're saying, and then I was at a parade the other day, and there were some people scantily clad and with their bodies painted, etc. And there were people carrying signs saying, this is an abomination in the name of God. You are gays and lesbians all painted up like this, and it's God's abomination. But it was vicious. But they were doing it out of their good faith. They weren't doing it to be vicious. So I'm saying that the claim that we are to participate in God's work in the world has great problems with it in a day like ours. And it has been every day. The Crusades were to participate in God's work in the world. The Inquisition was. Mm-hmm. The conquest and the genocide of the American Indians, for some people, had to do with participating in God's work. So I'm going to... I've thought about this because I can't avoid my conviction that that's why we're here. And I can't avoid that... Some of the worst things in human history have been done in the name of participating in God's work. So how do you deal with that? And one thing that I've concluded is that and this comes straight from Lutheran theology, that we cannot claim to know with absolute truth what God is doing in the world. Mm-hmm. We can never say, I am certain. And that comes out of a doctrine of sin. We are fallible. We are finite. We have learned that it would be idolatry to say that I know God perfectly. This side of death, we will never know God perfectly. We will know through a veil. So we always know that my claim of what is right cannot be an absolute claim. It's got to be after the most faithful discernment that I can do and do in community with others and with other voices and listening to them. With the work of discernment, this is what I believe I must do. And then do it. Not knowing, admitting that I might be wrong and I might be only partially wrong. To say that differently, we disbelieve any claim to absolute knowledge of God's way or will. As well as we disbelieve any claim that we are therefore excused from seeking to live in congruence with God's will. Do you follow me? That's a paradox. We disbelieve any claim to absolute knowledge, and we firmly disbelieve that we can use that as an excuse not to act. How many people do you know decide not to act because they just can't figure out what's the right thing to do?
Can you say the second part of that?
We disbelieve any claim to absolute knowledge of God's way or will, as well as any claim that God's people are therefore excused from seeking to live according to it. So there we live in that paradoxical reality that all of, and we can talk about much more, but I'm just going to throw that out as one kind of a guideline. A second guideline that I'm going to suggest is that the essential to discerning where God is at work is to become more apt in seeing. And I think specifically of three kinds of seeing, and I call this critical mystical seeing. More apt in seeing, one, what is the social realities and ecological realities in which we swim? That cause unnecessary suffering and that we tend not to see. In Bonhoeffer's terms, this would be unmasking evil that parades as good. Unmasking evil that parades as good. Seeing the social realities that we accept that cause suffering that's unnecessary and that we participate in, but that are invisible to us. That's a task of seeing. In ethical terms, we call that seeing what is. And the second is seeing what could be. That is seeing alternatives. We're locked, I see some of you nodding. The extent to which we get locked into not seeing alternatives. The world right now is filled with, I was at the World Social Summit of the UN on social development, talking about economic and development for people. And there were over 1,000 groups there, NGOs from different continents working on specific economic alternatives to economic globalization as we know it, all over the place. We could talk more about that, but the idea of seeing alternatives. And third is seeing the power and presence of God at work, coursing through all of creation, working toward abundant life for all. Looking for, seeing, acknowledging God's presence in the work to bring abundant life for all. So I call this seeing what is, seeing what could be, and seeing the power and presence of God. In the context of life ways that are destroying, that are destructive, like the reading I just did in here, that parade as good, or life destructive life ways parade as good, some of the things that we've talked about, structural sin, I think that those three forms of seeing are integral to Christian discipleship. Seeing what is, what could be, and the power and presence of God at work. I would suggest that seeing is moral seeing, and it's an imperative of faith. That there is a tremendous weight, a moral weight, that rests in what we see and how we see, what we refuse to see, and what we choose to see. That when we accept uncritically illusions about our world, we simply carry on with destructive and oppressive ways of life without seeking to counter them. When good, compassionate people don't see the consequences and costs of our ways of living, then we just accept them as normal, natural, inevitable, God's will, and carry on with them. One passage in the biblical texts that really strikes me about this is when Jesus, according to the authors of Mark, says, do you know what I'm going to say? Anyone can guess the text?
You gotta give us a little bit more.
A little bit more, you're right. Of course I do. That's not enough. I'll just read it. Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? It's in Mark 8, 17 to 18. I'd like to take a minute. We're on the first problem, and that is the problem of moral ambiguity. And I'm suggesting that two tools in that are disclaiming absolute knowledge or an excuse to act in the face of it. And a second tool is three different forms of seeing: what is, what could be, and God's power and presence, critical mystical seeing. I want to spend some time making real amongst us the need for that first kind of seeing, what is. And there are many ways we could do that. I'd like us to spend some time, since everyone in this room, I think everyone in this room identifies as white, let's talk about the seeing of, or the inability to see, white privilege, or what many people call white dominance in our society. I think that's an easy, not an easy one, I think it's a good exercise and tool for grasping what is often called moral blindness. In the context of race relations, it's called white blindness, the blindness of white people to white privilege. Have some of you done work on this? Some work on this? Do you have a question?
Can we, before we get into the specific,
yeah,
can we go back to all you've just laid out a little bit?
Oh, so meaning.
Just have a...
You want me to go out of order here? Okay, you mean what are the other clues? Is
no,
that what
no,
you
no, 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 you just...
Recap?
I'm wrestling with this, what you present as a paradox between saying no to the absolute and yes, but not using that as a pretense to say yes to my calling.
Okay.
Because...
Yes.
At that point, for me, it becomes... Yes. Semantics.
Okay.
I mean, I can't say I know absolutely, but I can say I know. Or I assume, or I suggest. I mean, what you're saying is, as long as a person doesn't say this is absolute, then it's okay to say I know, or to say I assume, or to say I think.
Okay.
I mean, there's a nuance there of, I mean, the prophet said, thus saith the Lord. You know, that was a pretty strong statement. And some were true prophets and some were false prophets, but they all said, thus saith the Lord. So,
okay.
There has to be some discerning about what I understand to be the direction that I am called to go, and trust that that is true for me, and hopefully others will join in that journey.
Okay. My response to that would be, one
part of my response would be that key there in what you're saying is how we discern, which is part of what we're talking about. What goes into discerning what we think the Lord saith. But I would also say that there is a distinct difference between saying, God, I know that this is what God wants, and therefore I'll do it. I know that. I know that absolutely. I think there's a distinct difference between that and saying, I am not sure, I am not absolutely sure what is, absolutely sure what is the way to go here. But I've done discerning to the best that I can, and this is the best I can discern. I might be off, or I might be only partial. I think there's a difference in saying those two things. I'll take a, because dramatic examples sometimes serve better than more common examples. I'll take Bonhoeffer and his decision, I think I already mentioned that, in to join with the plot to assassinate Hitler. Bonhoeffer was nearly a pacifist. He had been on his way to study with Gandhi and was moving towards pacifism and had studied in America with a great French pacifist when he was at Union Theological Seminary and was close to being a true pacifist when he was invited and moved to participate in the plot to assassinate Hitler. And Bonhoeffer wrestled in his soul. What's right? Do I kill? Or do I not? And Bonhoeffer finally concludes that he's not sure what's right, but he must act. And so he says, his words are, he throws himself on the grace of God, knowing that even though he may be doing wrong, he's in the arms of God. But he's discerned strongly, faithfully. And I would just suggest that there's a difference. If I have that caveat in mind, I then must be open to other voices saying, wait a minute. If I know that I am not absolute, then I must hear if someone else is saying, but wait, what about this? Rick, you had your hand up.
I wrestle with the same thing, but I work in a secular world.
Uh-huh.
And I work with public health specialists and emergency managers.
Yes.
And both of them have in their mental framework or conceptual map of the concept of causes and effects.
Uh-huh.
And in discernment, I can't talk to them in terms of discernment, so to speak, but I can talk to them about causes and effects in a way that they can begin to think of what is right and wrong for either themselves or for the population on whose behalf they are working. And both public health and emergency management specialists have a kind of agreed upon creed that they're the main force of their work is to decrease suffering wherever possible. And I think you could even argue that that is something, at least I would argue that that is something that would be in consonance with the will of God. I don't know that, but I would argue that. And so what I try to do in working with the people I work with is, going back to the scenario we had of the congregation and not knowing that the things they are doing are actually having negative effects, is have people look at effects, okay, which is an educational challenge, particularly if they don't want to see it, and that's often the case, they start to look towards future effects. And then look at the causes, the causal relationships of, that lead to things, and the potential outcomes of decisions or actions that you take now. Okay, knowing full well that there may be complications, there may be outcomes that you hadn't anticipated. But the best choice that you can make if you're trying to decrease suffering is based on a sense of causes and effects and relationship between what you do now and some effects into the future.
Okay, I think that's a very good point. I think in that process of discernment, how am I going to come to what will be the best way of reducing suffering or the best way of serving God? I think that is very much a key question. I work with what I call reality revealing questions. And one of them is, what are the short-term and the long-term consequences? Who benefits and who loses? And then if we map that out, then there's some kind of a chart to map it out, then seeing those consequences is, as you say, almost necessary to figuring out what is really going to be the best to mitigate against suffering. Yes.
And following on that, having spent 40 years of my life studying science.
Yes.
And how I resolved the potential conflict of that with my religious beliefs. The best of science is simply not accepting anything as never knowing what's really true, but always trying to prove things false and to be a contrarian. And that the basic rule is we deceive ourselves, and we'll go along with all kinds of crazy beliefs until we prove ourselves wrong. Well, as Christians, I see our role. What Jesus was really concerned with is we deceive ourselves. The Lutheran confession. We deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us.
Okay.
And therefore, to me, one of the real clues of trying to see the work of God in the world is to be a little bit contrarian. If everybody's believing something and all hyped up about it, then what's the understory? What is this other side of that? Can you falsify that? And often there's God.
Right, exactly. Very, 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 very interesting. One of the quotes that I have a ton of quotes about seeing, moral seeing, and one of them is just that, to be human is to be self-deceived. and that's what I'm talking about. Self-deceived, evil masquerading as good. Because of our self-curved in ourselves, our propensity to self-interest. One of the other reality-revealing questions, I wasn't even going to bring these up, but both Bob here and Rick have pointed to them. One of the others that I say to my students at the beginning of the term, you have to put in your mind as a boilerplate question to live with. Have this in your mind. Try to have it there all the time when you go through life. This is something I try to do. And this has to do with what you were just saying. What in any given situation do we presuppose to be natural or normal or inevitable or God's will? What do we, give me an example of atrocities, things that were later figured out to be moral atrocities that were perceived as natural or normal or inevitable or God's will.
Bringing African Americans to the United States because they are inferior.
Okay, by nature.
By nature, they're
inferior. By nature. Even in Darwin, we see inferior races by nature. The black was considered inferior. By God's will, they were brought here. Okay, anything else? Yes?
Gay people, how gay people are treated.
Okay. Okay, by God's will? Okay, all right, very good. And it's presupposed that it's natural to be heterosexual. We presuppose that is what's natural when science is telling us that there's homosexuality, which is an 18th century word anyway, it doesn't, but throughout nature, many, many, many different animals. But we presuppose that the only natural form is, okay. So this question of self-deception, I try to get at it by having people walk through life saying, what is presupposed to be normal? It's presupposed to be normal that we drive cars every day. Mind you, this is not something that's normal. and it's presupposed to be inevitable that we'll just go on. So those are four keys, I think. And so those are two good reality-revealing questions
normal,
to ask in terms
normal,
of...
Normal, inevitable, natural.
Yeah. Normal, natural, inevitable, or divinely ordained. And they often go together.
Yeah.
But those, I think, are the four deceptive, perceptive lenses.
One in particular that comes to mind is the thorn will always be among us.
Okay.
It's used often as a justification.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
What are you going to do? They're always going to, Jesus said that, so.
You bet. And that's conceived as God's will and inevitable.
Mm-hmm. If people
go back, normal.
If kids go back as a committee and ask Jesus not to say certain things,
the deed. Okay, press the deed. Good. Well, I think that this business of yes. Oh, Clara.
I don't want to derail your trajectory here, and this may be a different vexing problem, but it's so firmly tied in with the moral paradox that I thought I would bring it up now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that it's really great for me internally to hold side by side the moral uncertainty and yet my obligation to act.
Yes, okay.
But when I'm talking to other people, or when I'm dealing with trying to affect change that that requires the participation and assent and enthusiasm of groups of other people, I don't know how to speak with conviction to them without either appearing very arrogant or undermining what I feel I have to do or judging other people.
Yeah. Okay. So how do we speak with conviction without certitude? The dilemma that we live with, to be honest, is with given that we are fallible and finite, how do we act and speak with moral conviction and persuasively, because that's part of the task often, without moral certitude? And I shouldn't say how do we. I'm just going to say right now, that's the situation that we live with, if we believe that we are to love neighbor as self in the context of morally ambiguous social realities. Yes.
Just triggers on me. What, at least according to the Book of Acts, what was so influential in the apostles was that they spoke with such confidence and boldness. Those are the two words that we used. You know, how do we speak confidently and boldly without appearing? Absolute.
Without appearing absolute or being absolute. Without appearing or being. Knowing that we're limited in what we know to be right. Good point. Boldness and confidence, yes.
You know, I often wonder how people are going to perceive what I say or do.
Mm.
And that's not something that I'm going to know. I have to leave the results up to God. Because I can be very abrasive, without meaning to, but I can't run my life according to how I think others are going to perceive me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But there is also the part about being effective.
Yeah.
You know, there's a balance there. You know.
I mean, you say the truth in love, but you say the truth.
Okay.
You don't keep that when you know that it needs to be spoken.
And sometimes you say the truth, and in terms of social realities, it's got to be the truth, even though you're not sure it's the absolute truth. Yeah, very good. Yes.
Doesn't this kind of bring us back to humility that we were discussing a couple days
yes.
ago? Because somehow I'm not very good at that at all. I say what I think and what I know, what I think I know, and I'm positive about it. Very, you know, I could run over everything else.
Mm-hmm.
If I could somehow manage to convey my humility as a child of God in that, and that would be.
Okay, very good. Very good. A couple more, and then we're going to go on. I'm right here.
I think St. Paul is a good example when he was talking to the people of Athens. He pointed out where he agreed with them instead of saying, you folks are all wrong because you worship idols. And this is what's right. Because you get nowhere in pointing out where people are wrong.
Good point.
Sort of find out where your common ground is.
Lovely. One comment back here. Yes.
I brought up science, and science is certainly not the domain of humility necessarily. But science has built into its process something that I try to use in my daily life as well as my life as a scientist, and that is that when you present something, you present the evidence that, in fact, that might be the case, that you think that's the case. But at the end of your presentation, you also show evidence that might mitigate against what you're saying. You admit that there are other ways perhaps that these data might come out or might be viewed. And I think that lends toward a sense of humility. This is the best I can do, but I'm not saying that it's perfect. And that's built into the structure of scientific presentation. I think it works for us.
It's interesting. It also points, and this is a completely different subject, and we won't go there, but to the incredible importance of the science and theology or science and religion dialogue. That is just, I mean, that's a whole other session, but I think there are things to be learned by both from methodology and content of each other. Okay, let's move on a little bit here. Let me just suggest where we are. We're talking about moral ambiguity, but the need to act. We're talking about the tool of seeing, what is, what could be, the power and presence of God, three seeings. We're focusing on that seeing what is. We're going to spend a little bit more time there. We have till 10 till. And I want to move on to, well, we may save the second two problems for the next session, but I want to move on partly, a little bit, to at least one of them. But back to seeing. I have a hunch it's one of the most formidable and necessary tasks in front of people of privilege, either economically as we are, extraordinarily economically, privilege, or privilege by color. I have a sense that it's one of the most important things we can learn to change the way the world is going. And I want us to play with it a little bit. I want us to play with the prevalence of white blindness so that we can start to see the power of moral blindness. Let me share with you. Does anyone know the article by Peggy McIntosh? Backpack of Privilege? Peggy, is it called the Backpack of Privilege?
You mentioned it yesterday.
Pardon me?
Just that you mentioned it yesterday.
Yesterday. Okay, let me read about a paragraph and then we'll do a little exercise. She writes, "My schooling gave me no training in seeing myself as an oppressor." That's familiar. "As an unfairly advantaged person or as a participant in a damaged culture," structural sin in theological words. "I was taught to see myself as an individual whose moral state depended upon her individual moral will. I will choose to be virtuous and good," and I... Okay. "At school, we were not taught about slavery in any depth. We were not taught to see slaveholders as damaged people. Slaves were seen as the only group at risk of being dehumanized by slavery. My schooling followed this pattern. Whites are taught to think of their lives as morally neutral, normative, average, ideal. So that when we work to benefit others, this is seen as work that will allow them to be more like us, have the same kind of life that we have. I decided to try to work on myself by identifying some of the daily effects of white privilege in my life.
It's crude work at this stage, but I'll give here a list of special circumstances and conditions that I experienced, which I did not earn, but which I have been made to feel are mine by birth, or by citizenship, or by virtue of being a conscientious, law-abiding, normal person of goodwill. I've chosen conditions which I think, in my case, attach more to skin color privilege than to class, religion, or geographical location, or nationality. There are also those privileges. Though all of these are factors that are intricately intertwined. As far as I can see, my Afro-American co-workers, friends, and acquaintances, with whom I come into daily or frequent contact, cannot count on most of these conditions. So take a minute to think about conditions of life, privileges in your life, that you have because you're white, that you wouldn't have if you were a different skin color. And let's also, given our own day, think, or you can think of privileges that you have because you're a U.S. citizen, national privileges, that you don't have, you wouldn't have if you were a person of color from another country. Are you following me? Okay. Take just a minute. I'm going to start us off with one example that I've often given. My husband, sitting over there, is a pretty big, strong-looking guy, and he runs in the morning. And he gets up early sometimes, and he can run before it's fully light, and he could run by, say, a 7-Eleven store without even thinking about whether or not the police are going to pick him up. My neighbor is a very dark black man, and he would never dream of running before dawn in front of a 7-Eleven store without wondering if a police car came by, if he was going to be stopped. My husband has that privilege, but he doesn't.
I'm just curious. Does he? Have you actually had this conversation with? I mean, is this something that you guys? I'm not trying to question you. I'm just curious whether you have had a conversation actually about that. You know?
With this man, I haven't. I have with other African American men.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Not that he wouldn't run by the 7-Eleven, but in his mind, if a cop car drove by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For another example of that would be, we were going to a protest march once, my family and I, and. One of my sons didn't want to go. He really didn't want to go. And there could be all kinds of reasons. He could have wanted to watch, you know, something on his computer, but he didn't want to go. And I finally understood. He said something that made me say, well, Leif, you know there will be police there. And he said, oh, well, then I'll go. In other words, meaning that the police were going to make him feel safe. I told that to an African-American woman who was a friend of mine, and she said, listen, that's white privilege. Mm-hmm. My son would not feel safer because police were there. So think of any others. What can you do because you're white? Yes.
Well, I have my brother-in-law is Mexican.
Yes.
He's a naturalized citizen. Mm-hmm. There happens to be kind of a belligerent policeman who mm-hmm. sits by this overpass mm-hmm. near where they live. And he has harassed my brother-in-law several mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. Wants to know where he's going, where uh-huh. he's from.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
He sits there, I think, mainly to watch for speeders, but does stop.
Okay.
Him.
Okay.
And my brother-in-law is really quite, I mean, he's an American citizen just like you and me, but he does worry about things like that.
Okay. Very good example. Very good example. Let's think also not, I mean, there's no way I want to be very, very clear. I am not dissing police men or women.
No.
They're no more white, have no more white blindness than you or I do. And that is a very good example. Let's think of some that don't necessarily pertain to police. Education, schooling, shopping. Yes.
Well, money is part of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, we have a car for every member of our family. We have a cell phone for every member of our family. And actually, most of the people we know have the same.
Okay.
Even though they don't have as much money as we do, that's a choice that they're making.
Okay. And then that would be connected to white privilege by the fact that economically, white Americans are far, by average, far wealthier than Hispanic or African Americans. The privilege of assuming of... And how does that happen? Are there any specific examples of white privilege that enable white people to have more money?
Being hired for jobs.
Okay, zap. Being hired.
We may have affirmative action, but in reality, you know, no one completes affirmative action to the extent that it is affirmative.
Okay. Just in response to that, one of my students recently gave me a printout from some research that she had read, I can't remember the source, indicating that the extent to which white people's CVs, when they're sent in for job applications, are far more responded to, they get interviews more than black people do. Okay, so you could say that there's nothing on that CV to indicate that someone's white or black. So why are white people going to be three times, my son has the privilege of having three times more likelihood of being called for an interview by someone who sees his CV than a lot of black young men of his age. What they found was the names. Many names are used by black people and many by white, and black names don't get called in. So that, you're right, that's a direct connection to the privilege of money that you're talking about. Any others in that vein? Yes.
I want to talk about two, and one is sort of related to the running example, but more generally is mm-hmm. anonymity.
Being able
to go places and blend in.
Okay.
Or most of the traveling I've done, either in this country or in Europe, just to be to be assumed to be harmless or to be assumed to belong.
Okay.
And that comes with, you know, people offering to help, you know, being friendly when you ask for directions. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a vulnerable situation, mm-hmm. then to have a lot of resources at your command.
Okay.
And the second is not being, by virtue of being white, I'm not taken as a representative of my race.
Okay.
Whereas if I were black, many of the things I said or mm-hmm. did would be considered exemplary.
Okay, if you're sitting in a room and you say something, subtly, someone isn't thinking of you as representing your race.
I'm just an individual. Uh-huh. You know, if I behave badly, I'm just a bad person or an annoying person. If I'm black, then, you know, then I'm reflecting badly on my
okay.
race.
Very good. Let's think about that. One woman talked to me about how she has to teach her sons not to chew with their mouths open. Because if this black kid is sitting in a room with a bunch of white kids, and this black kid is chewing with his mouth open, there are going to be little subconscious assumptions going on that, black people do that. He's a representative of his race in that sense. There was a hand up right here.
And I think cultural background, too. Okay. We live in a community where there are a lot of Native Americans, and it's changing with generations. Mm-hmm. But when I was teaching Native mm-hmm. Americans, they didn't ever want to do anything that would look like they were trying to raise themselves above their mm-hmm. peers. So that would have to do with education. And oftentimes we would assume that they could do their homework at home. Well, mm-hmm. parents sometimes were illiterate.
Okay.
They had no books at home, no magazines, so you can't answer questions about.
Okay.
So it's a culture, can be a cultural thing, but thankfully that's changing.
Okay.
And they're elevating education.
Very good. And that also comes back to another thing of the economic advantage. So let's think also of more examples of the privilege of economic privilege that comes with the color white that we usually don't think about. Yes.
Well, just even in a grocery store, the ethnic food section.
Right. Okay, so you go into a grocery store and you can find food that is culturally appropriate to you. Mm-hmm. You can go to a hair salon and find someone who knows how to cut your hair. If you're in, what's a pretty white town? Think of a white town.
What's it?
Shelby, Montana.
Okay, in Shelby, Montana, if you're black, you might have a hard time finding someone to cut your hair. Okay, you might have a hard time finding hair products in the store.
Absolutely.
Okay. What about travel? Any travel notions? Yes, Joanna.
Just going to South America and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think being white, people just, you know, admire you and kind of dote on you. Like, okay. in their mind is imprinted that white people are better than them. That's really sad.
Beautiful example. Mm-hmm. Beautiful example. White people don't have the internalized oppression that people of color face by this all the things to suggest that white is better. So that even within, when you talk with people of different colors other than white, you see the skin color privilege within the color ranges. African people of African descent who are lighter being discriminating against those who are darker. So the internalized oppression that sees white as better. All the Barbie dolls are all white. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was interesting when my husband and I were teaching in Japan. Our Japanese language teacher emphasized to us many times that she wanted us to know that they were not black.
Oh, that they were not black.
They were not black. They weren't connected with black.
Okay.
Yeah. Just in case we didn't know that.
Okay, wanting to be disassociated then, being seen, it's kind of part of what Joanna was saying too, the privilege of being considered by many as normative. I think that raises also, and then I'll get to these two hands, I think that raises another really important point, and that's the point of how whiteness is defined. We think that whiteness is white, but 2 weeks ago I was in a room and I didn't know who was white and who wasn't. Because whiteness is not just the color of your skin. It's many things attached, and whiteness has been constructed by white people over history as a way of giving some privilege and others not. For instance, let me give you an example. In South Africa under apartheid, African Americans in working with the American embassy were considered white. They were white. There were legal debates. Legally, there have been debates all over about who's white and who's not. There was a time when it was back in the history of our U.S. when they were debating are Chinese and American whites. And legally, at that point in that part of the country, Mexicans were considered white and Chinese not. There was a time in the Pacific Northwest when Swedes weren't considered white. There's a document I read about some of the logging camps. And someone writes, don't go to that camp. There's no white folks there, just Swedes. So white people of English, French, Northern European descent, then we get white. So someone who's got very, very white skin, the conference I was at a week ago, someone with very, very white skin was not white. She was in the Hispanic American, the Latina group. So whiteness gets constructed, and those who are the white or speak with the accent that we consider a normal white accent I'm just going to throw out one about traveling. Think about going through security. I was going through security with a friend from India. No, I was talking with a friend from India, very mild guy, a professor colleague, and he said when he goes through security now at the airport, he is always stopped. And his white colleagues aren't. He's always stopped. So there were a couple of other hands up. Let's take two or three more very quickly, or people that haven't spoken, and then we need to stop.
I want to give an example of white, not white sort of thing.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was traveling with a professor from Reed College who had a beard and was kind of hippie looking.
Yes.
And I was pretty straightforward looking.
Yes.
And we were going into Canada.
Yes.
And he says, watch, I'll get stopped and you won't.
Oh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Just because of the way he didn't look like
what
the regular white guy should.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good. And very good. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, when I was in college, I had a roommate from Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go to places. And this was, the middle of the civil rights.
Oh, yes, yes.
She was very acceptable because she was from Africa. She was not African American.
Uh-huh. Okay. Another very, very good example.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Rick.
This is really insidious. And I'm thinking particularly, you were asking about health.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, excuse me, about economics.
Mm-hmm.
With economics and health and race and racism were very mixed in together.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I'm listed as Caucasian, and so my health insurance and my life insurance are likely to be lower in cost than it would be for a similar 57-year-old African-American. And the insurance agencies can say, well, yeah, that's because African-Americans have a higher mortality rate at a lower age and a higher level of diabetes and obesity. But when you reverse the picture, it's the same exact African-Americans who aren't afforded the health care that would help them overcome some of those things.
Okay.
So it's a double whammo that that I just, you know, it goes by as an economic advantage for me that I never even see.
Yes.
Except that I work in the healthcare industry, so I'm aware of it.
But so that's so perfect. And the way you said that, an economic advantage that we don't see if we're not on the underside of it. Very, very, very good example. Yes.
And I don't think we can talk about this without talking about our criminal justice system.
Okay.
I, as a white person, will be released quicker than a, or more likely than an African American person. I will be executed less likely than an African American.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. If you go in for a mortgage, the equal white person and equal black person appearing of the same class status, the white person is much more likely to get the mortgage than the black person.
Even though the form says there will be no discrimination.
Right, right.
Big letters.
Right. Okay, so folks, these are really good examples. And what we've been doing, just to contextualize this, is we've been just trying to plow into, dig into a claim. And that's the claim that we who are advantaged by nation, by color, by economy, and this would also go by gender, we who are advantaged don't recognize. We don't tend to see, we're blind to our advantage, and therefore, we let it go on. Whereas if we were not blind to it and we began to see it, then we could be what is called a white ally. We could be an ally who is trying to stand up against that kind of advantage divide. An example, and then there are many ways to be white ally.
But we like the advantage.
Well, we like it. So, but let's say hypothetically that out of our conviction to love neighbor as self, let's say even though we're going to be honest and we like it, let's say out of our conviction to be loving neighbor as self, we say, I'm not going to accept injustice in my life. I'm not going to take advantage to it. To oppose it, we have to see it. We just have to see that it exists to oppose it. So all of the things we just said are things that we could stand as allies. If I saw a, who's the famous, the woman who was the governor of Texas, and she's standing by this black guy?
Richard.
Yeah, she's standing by this black guy, and someone comes up, some person, and ignores the black guy, and comes up, this person who comes up doesn't know she's a governor. She's just a woman. Introduces himself, starts talking, and ignores the black guy sitting beside her. And finally, she takes this black guy's arm and says, and pretends she's his wife. You know, I was thinking if you were going through, I fly a lot, and if you were going through the security thing and someone's getting really harassed, you see that that's going to happen, you could always go up and say, is there difficulty here with my fiancé? You know, you could be an ally.
That way.
Yes.
Careful.
Now you know.
That's what happens with you. Okay, yes.
It's something very hard for those of us who are privileged to give up on. It was an experiment at Stanford where they took every freshman, they matched them all perfectly by the SAT scores. Mm-hmm. Intellectually, they were identical, at least as performance on a test. And then they gave them two tests of African-American males, females, and white males, females. And they one test just was said nothing on it, and the African Americans underperformed the white. Then they stayed at the top of the test. This test has been carefully constructed so that there's no race bias. The two scores were equivalent, but the absolute score of the whites declined.
Oh my goodness.
Because there's an advantage, a perceived advantage in being superior.
Okay.
So
okay.
You have to give up that advantage if you take this seriously.
Okay, that's a good segue for ending. That if we want to give up advantage in the name of neighbor love, the point that I'm trying to make here, you know, go all the way back is in the face of moral ambiguity. One of the things one of our tools for knowing what God is doing, let's say for knowing what God is doing in this world. To get to that kind of discernment, one of the things we need to do is see more clearly what is going on. Mm-hmm. Seeing what is. Yes, we also need to see alternatives. How we can be what some people call white allies or others call race traitors. How we can, that is the alternatives. We need to flesh that out. But first we need to see what the dickens is going on. And that one dimension of that is seeing our privilege. So we only really got to working on one problem, and we didn't get to the end of that, but the next, just to let you know, the other two problems that I wanted to work on, and we will work on them, one is the notion, the feeling of, I can't make any difference. The feeling of despair or hopelessness that I can't make any difference. And the third problem that I want to work on is courage. Mm-hmm. Where do we get the courage to take steps to make a difference? So those are the two things that I'd like to work on in continuing this issue of problems.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all.